boats in Boston's public garden and living in Cambridge with Angus. My brother is a crazy genius, Joey told Blair. He's helping NASA with a moon launch. Blair's ears had perked up. He's an astronaut? Blair was obsessed with astronauts. She'd covered her dorm room corkboard with pictures of Jim Lovell and Pete Conrad, and the most handsome astronaut of all, Gordon Cooper. Not an astronaut exactly, Joey said. I mean, he's not going up in the rocket. He just does the calculations that make the rockets fly. Close enough, Blair thought. If she and Joey ended up getting married, she would have a brother-in-law who was almost an astronaut. Although Blair considered herself a modern woman, getting married was never far from her mind. Nearly all of Blair's Wellesley classmates were engaged by the time they graduated. The exception was Blair's best friend, Sally, who, like Blair, wanted a career. A truly modern woman, Blair thought, could have both. Blair liked Joey. He was handsome, fun-loving, and easy to be with. If Blair had a complaint, it was that he was maybe too easy. But, she reasoned, she was complicated enough for both of them. Joey was head over heels for Blair, and she got swept up by the wave of his enthusiasm. He once sent a bouquet of fat red roses to Blair at the Windsor School, and the administration saw fit to deliver it right in the middle of Blair's lecture on Carson McCullers. Blair's students all swooned, and Frankie from the member of the wedding was forgotten as the girls buried their noses in the flowers and inhaled what they naively believed to be the scent of true love. The weekend after the distracting arrival of the roses, Joey invited Blair for a private ride on his swan boat. It was early October, and the leaves in the Boston Public Garden were at their most flamboyant. Joey pedaled to the middle of the pond, produced a bottle of cold duck, and poured it into waxy paper cups. He and Blair drank and talked and laughed until dusk descended. At some point, they started kissing, really kissing, and the swan boat tilted first in one direction, then the other. Joey broke away, out of breath. "Will you come to my place?" he asked. "Please?" Blair didn't want Joey to think she was too easy, but the cold duck had gone right to her head. "Okay," she said, "but no promises." Joey's place was the entire ground floor of one of the gracious turn-of-the-century mansions on Mount Auburn Street. Blair had been expecting a bachelor pad, posters of Jane Mansfield and Marilyn Monroe, piles of dirty laundry, empty beer cans. But when Joey opened the door and ushered Blair inside, she was pleasantly surprised. A framed print of Edouard Manet's A Bar at the Folies Bergères hung in the entryway, and Blair heard Rachmaninoff playing somewhere in the house. Art? Blair thought. Classical music? Damn, Joey said. My brother's home. When they stepped into the great room, Blair took a quick inventory. Persian rug, leather sofa, mirror-topped cigar table, and, most impressive, a wall of floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. At the far end of the room, a man sat at the head of a long harvest table, working by the light of three pillar candles. This was Joey's brother, Blair realized, Angus, the almost astronaut. He was bent over a notebook, scribbling furiously. He didn't even seem to notice them come in. Joey was visibly perturbed. "I thought you were going to the faculty potluck." Angus didn't respond. "He's working," Blair thought. "Leave him be." It was clear, however, that it would be rude to withdraw to the bedroom for amorous pursuits. "Angus," Joey said, "get out of here. We'd like some privacy." Angus held up an index finger as he scribbled something in his notes. "Got it." He slammed the notebook shut and, with this action, seemed to re-enter the present moment. He said, "Who is we?" And then he noticed Blair and leaped to his feet. "Hello?" he said. He moved toward Blair tentatively, as though she were an exotic bird that might fly away. "Who are you?" Behind Angus's glasses, Blair noticed, were a pair of tender brown eyes. Her head buzzed with the effects of the cold duck. "Blair Foley," she said, offering her hand. "It's nice to meet you. I just love your apartment. I noticed the Manet print when I walked in. That painting is a particular favorite of mine."
"Did you study art history, then?"
Angus asked.
"I thought you were going to the faculty potluck," Joey said again.
"Literature, actually," Blair said. "Female novelists, to be specific. Edith Wharton, to be specifically specific."
"Edith Wharton," Angus said.
Blair was about to proffer her standard one-line Wharton biography, American novelist born into the upper echelons of New York society who was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for Literature, because lots of people, especially men, had no idea who Edith Wharton was. But then Angus said,
"I've read all her work."
"Have you?" Blair assumed Angus was making fun of her. "Which novel was your favorite?" Joey made a loud snoring noise, which was the kind of dismissive attitude Blair expected from men when she discussed Wharton. She ignored him.
"The Age of Innocence," Angus said. "Countess Olenska is positioned as the other against the lily-white backdrop of May Welland."
"You have read it," Blair said.
"Yes," Angus said. "I told you. I've read them all."
"Of course," Blair said. "It's just that Joey told me you were an astrophysicist." Angus offered her a wry smile.
"And astrophysicists aren't allowed to enjoy Wharton?"
Blair was dazzled. She felt suddenly connected to Angus, as though they had both visited the same far-off country. Joey snatched up Angus's notebook and held it over the candle flames.
"Get out of here, Angus, or this goes up in smoke."
"Joey," Blair said. Angus shook his head.
"He does this all the time," he said. "Acts like a child to get attention."
He took Blair's hand.
"Please, can I take you to dinner?"
Blair looked into Angus's soft brown eyes and thought, this date just got very complicated. Blair and Angus's wedding had been a small but lavish affair at the Union Club, paid for by Exalta, who had taken a particular shine to Angus. With Exalta, one was considered remarkable or one was barely noticed. Those were the only two options. Blair herself fell into the latter category, but then so did most people. Blair had suspected Exalta would view Angus's rarefied intellect with disdain, but Exalta thought Angus was just marvelous, and when Blair and Angus got engaged, Exalta's opinion of Blair seemed to improve. Blair loved being a bride. She loved her dress, a trumpet silhouette with lace overlay, a satin sash under the bust line, and a low dip in the back. It was from Priscilla's of Boston, and Blair had been fitted by Priscilla herself, which made her feel like Grace Kelly. Blair loved licking stamps for the invitations and then checking the mail for the reply cards. 50 guests were invited, 42 accepted. Blair asked her sister Kirby to be the maid of honor, her best friend Sally to be the bridesmaid, and her sister Jessie to be the junior bridesmaid. Blair chose peonies and lilies for her flowers, a palette of pink and green, and they were granted a stunning June day. The lamb and the duck at the reception was a welcome change from beef and chicken, and Exalta had agreed to French champagne, Bollinger. Blair and Angus danced to Fly Me to the Moon, which was a joke about Angus's job. They held hands under the table through Joey Whalen's sweet, funny, and very drunken toast.
"We all worried you would never find a wife, and you didn't. I found her."
After the reception, Blair changed into a peach silk shift with dyed-to-match pumps, and they ran through a shower of rice to the getaway car, Angus's black 1966 Ford Galaxy convertible, which had been festooned with crepe paper and empty tin cans. The honeymoon was a week in Bermuda at the Hamilton Princess. Pink sand,
men in knee socks, sex. Angus was an accomplished lover, and Blair figured it must be a natural gift, like his intelligence, because he told her he had never had a real girlfriend before her. However, it was on their honeymoon that Blair learned that the nimble, lightning-quick gymnastics of Angus's mind came at a cost. On the third morning of their trip, Angus refused to get out of bed. He wasn't sleeping, he just lay there, his eyes open but vacant. Blair placed a hand on his forehead. His skin was cool. "Angus," she said, "you're scaring me. What is it?" He shook his head. Then his expression crumpled, and he appeared ready to cry. "What is it, Angus?" Blair asked. But of course, it could only be one thing. He didn't love her. He'd made a mistake in marrying her. "Angus?" "Please leave," he said, "just for a little while. I need to be alone." Blair left. What else could she do? She was relieved that at least it was temporary. Blair wandered the hotel gardens, filled with June roses and butterflies, then sat pensively with a cup of coffee on the patio until an hour had passed. When she returned to the room, she heard Angus's voice through the door. He was on the phone, she realized, which seemed like a good sign. She knocked, then entered. She heard Angus say, "I have to go now. Goodbye." Blair crossed the dim bedroom to kiss Angus's forehead. Still cool. "How are you feeling?" she asked.
"A bit better," he said.
She waited for him to tell her who he had been talking to, but he didn't, and she decided she wouldn't ask.
"I'm sorry," Angus said. "Some days I wake up and I'm just paralyzed."
Blair assured him that he didn't have to be sorry. She worried he had gotten too much sun or not enough sleep. She also suspected he was working too hard. Even here in Bermuda, he sat at the little round table on their balcony and pored over his calculations, and when he finished, he picked up one of the books he'd brought. He was reading Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha in the original German and, for fun, The Death of Ivan Ilyich.
"You're thinking too much," Blair said. "Your mind needs a rest, Angus."
"No, that's not it," he said. "It happens. It's an affliction."
He then confessed that he had been visited by these episodes since he was an adolescent. The paralysis, mental and emotional, came and went capriciously, like a ghost haunting a house. There was no predicting its cause or its duration. He had been to hospitals, tests had been run, pills prescribed, but nothing made it better.
"I didn't tell you because I didn't want you to think you were marrying damaged goods," Angus said.
"I would never think that, darling," Blair said.
She remembered Joey calling Angus a crazy genius. She'd thought Joey had been jealous. The rest of that summer passed in a blissful haze. Because the MIT students were on summer break, Angus had been able to join Blair on Nantucket. While she sunned herself on Cliffside Beach, he worked on his research at Blair's grandfather's desk. They often met in the late afternoons in the shaded garden next to the Nantucket Athenaeum, stopping at the Island Dairy Bar for one chocolate and vanilla soft-serve cone that they shared as they strolled back to All's Fair. In the evenings, they ate with the family, then either drove out to the beach in the galaxy and made love in the back seat, or walked up Main Street and sat side by side on a bench, sharing a cigarette and looking out over the twinkling lights of town. Once a week, they had date night at the Opera House, with its proper European waiters, all of them old and with heavy accents, or the Skipper, where the college-age servers sang show tunes. One day, Blair and Angus rode their bikes all the way out to Sankaty Head Lighthouse. Another day, they puttered Exalta's 13-foot Boston Whaler over to Kotu, where they sat on the beach under an umbrella. They were the only people there that day, so Angus untied Blair's bikini top
and kissed the length of her spine, then flipped her over and made love to her right out there in the open where passing boaters might see them. Blair had to admit, that only made it more thrilling. When they arrived back in the city after this extended honeymoon, they had their first argument. Angus told Blair that he didn't want her to return to Windsor.
"What are you talking about?" Blair said.
She had been working on lesson plans since the 1st of August. She had ordered 30 copies of Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man Is Hard to Find. Angus knew this. There were girls who had written to Blair on Nantucket to tell her how excited they were about taking her class.
"Of course I'm going back."
"No," Angus said. "I need you to stay home and handle things here."
"Handle what?" Blair said, though she knew he meant the house. Cleaning, cooking, shopping, laundry, errands.
"I'm more than capable of teaching and running the household, Angus."
He'd kissed her nose, and she nearly swatted him away. The gesture was so patronizing.
"You are more than capable. But you don't have to work. I make plenty of money, and we have your trust fund."
The trust fund was $50,000 that Blair had gotten when she graduated from Wellesley. It was now in an account at the Bank of Boston under both her and Angus's names.
"That money isn't meant to be squandered on day-to-day expenses," Blair said. "You know that."
"Blair," Angus said, "I don't want a wife who works. My job is very taxing. Please, I need you at home. I realize every marriage requires compromise, which is why I gave up my place in Cambridge."
"Wait," Blair said. It was true that she had lobbied to live in Boston proper, and now she and Angus were renting a modern two-bedroom on Commonwealth Avenue. But she hadn't realized that decision would put her job at risk.
"Blair," Angus said, "please."
"What am I going to do all day?" she asked.
"Do what other women do," Angus said. "And if you have any spare time, you can read."
Blair opened her remaining wedding presents. Some of them she returned. Toasters, teacups, an Angora blanket that shed like a St. Bernard, and some she placed around the apartment. Crystal vases, candy dishes, a Moroccan tagine pot that they would never use but that looked stylish on the open shelves of the dining nook. She wrote thank you notes on stationery engraved with her new monogram, BFW. She set up accounts at Savinor's on Charles Street, at the liquor store, at the hardware store. She placed the photos from the ceremony and reception in the white album that said, "Our Wedding," in foil-pressed letters on the front. When all of that was completed, Blair found herself at a loss for something to do. Angus had suggested she read, but now that Blair had hours to read, entire days to read, potentially an entire married lifetime to read, books lost their luster, and she grew resentful. Angus said he wanted her home, but for what reason? He worked all the time. He had classes to teach and graduate students to oversee, but what gobbled up most of his waking hours was the Apollo 11 mission. He was never home, and it didn't take long for Blair to wonder if she'd made an error when she'd traded one Whalen brother for the other. Joey Whalen had given Blair a secret wedding present, a slender silver lighter engraved with the words, "I loved you first. Eternally yours, Joey." Every time Blair smoked a cigarette, she felt secretly, deliciously desired. Really, was there any better gift? Blair half wanted Angus to discover the lighter. She started leaving it out, engraved side up. But Angus couldn't be bothered with the minutiae of Blair's life. So if there was one small secret between them, it was his own fault, she thought. At the end of September, Angus traveled to Houston, then to Cape Kennedy. Blair stayed home and kept house. She bought Mastering the Art of French Cooking and decided that she would become a gourmet cook and host fashionable salons twice a month,
evenings of cocktails and delectable bites where the conversation would focus on literature, art, music, history, and travel. Blair clung tight to the vision of these salons for a few feverish days, imagining that they would be in the same vein as gatherings hosted by the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. But then Blair tried and failed to make an edible poulet au porto 3 times, and she realized that Angus would never be able to commit to 2 nights home per month, and they didn't have any friends anyway. The middle of October brought the annual faculty potluck, the very same one Angus had famously skipped the year before. This time it was to be held at the home of Dr. Leonard Cushion, Professor Emeritus of Microbiology. He lived on Irving Street, a few doors down from Julia Child herself. Blair was excited for the potluck. Finally, a chance to get out of the house and socialize. She slaved over a potato galette made with clarified butter, thyme, and rosemary that, when cut into slender wedges, would be a sophisticated shared dish. She was eager to meet Angus's colleagues and enjoy some adult interaction. Blair wanted to appear serious and intellectual, and so she chose to wear black bell-bottoms with a black turtleneck. She pulled her normally bouncy blonde hair into a sleek ponytail and secured it with a black, orange, and pink poochie scarf that had been a gift from her friend Sally. Blair considered wearing silver hoop earrings, but feared they would make her seem frivolous. She decided the same about makeup. She applied only eyebrow pencil and clear lip gloss. When she came downstairs, Angus said, "That's what you're wearing?" Blair picked up the galette with 2 quilted oven mitts and strode ahead to the car. Angus knew a lot about astrophysics and a little bit about Edith Wharton, but he knew nothing of women's fashion. Or did he? Much to Blair's dismay, the other wives at the potluck were wearing sheath dresses or dirndl skirts in fall colors, goldenrod, flame orange, burgundy. They had all had their hair set and were in full makeup, complete with false eyelashes and bright lipstick. Blair was greeted by Mrs. Nancy Cushion, who was a good 30 years younger than the esteemed Professor Cushion. Blair handed Nancy the galette, and the other wives, Judy, Carol, Marion, Joanne, and Joanne, gave it sideways glances as they arranged trays of hors d'oeuvres, most of which appeared to be composed of 3 ingredients, cream cheese, olives, and toothpicks. By the time Blair finished introducing herself, Angus had disappeared.
"Where did my husband go?" Blair asked Nancy Cushion.
"Men in the den," Nancy said, raising her pencil-line eyebrows. "They drink bourbon, smoke cigars, and talk science." Blair was offered a glass of Chablis, which she gratefully accepted, and then a celery stick stuffed with salmon cream cheese and topped with paper-thin slices of olive, which she originally declined but then changed her mind and accepted. She turned to the person next to her, a woman who wore turquoise eyeshadow that exactly matched her silk bolero jacket.
"Have you read anything interesting lately?" Blair asked.
She hoped that this woman, Blair thought she was one of the Joannes, wouldn't mention Cancer Ward by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, because Blair had twice tried to read it but found it too bleak. "Maybe," Joanne said.
"Oh, please, the only thing I've read in the past 12 months is Pat the Bunny."
The very next day, Blair applied to the graduate English program at Harvard. She didn't say a word to Angus, telling herself it was a lark. She merely wanted to see if she could get in. She received a letter 3 weeks later. She had been accepted. Classes started in January. When Angus returned home that night, at 10:45, Blair was awake, waiting for him with a couple of glasses of good scotch that she'd bought to celebrate, and the acceptance letter. Angus had been displeased to find Blair still up.
"Whatever it is, we'll have to wait until morning," Angus said. "I feel an episode coming on."
"Just read this quickly, please," Blair said,
and she thrust the letter into his hands. Angus read the letter. There was no change in his expression.
"This is lovely news," he said when he finished it, and Blair clasped her hands to her heart. "But you're not going to go."
"What?" Blair said. "But it's Harvard. I got into Harvard, Angus."
"Didn't you tell me your grandfather went to Harvard?" Angus said. "That probably helped."
It was all Blair could do not to slap him. "I didn't mention my grandfather," she said in a tight voice.
But the arrow had hit its mark. Angus didn't believe Blair could be admitted to Harvard on her own merits. This pointed to a deeper, more disturbing truth. Angus didn't think Blair was as smart as Blair thought Angus was.
"We agreed you wouldn't work," Angus said.
"It's not work," Blair said. "It's school. Surely you, of all people..."
"Blair," he said, "we've been over this. Now, good night." Blair kept the acceptance letter in her lingerie drawer, where she saw it every day. She decided she would revisit the topic with Angus in a few weeks, during the morning hours, on a weekend perhaps, when it was less pressing for Angus to get to the university early. She would make sure he was feeling okay. She would cook corned beef hash with poached eggs, his favorite, and inform him that she was enrolling at Harvard despite his objections. After all, it was 1968. He couldn't tell her what to do. They spent their first Thanksgiving at Exalta's house in Beacon Hill. Blair made Julia Child's tarte normande aux pommes and presented it proudly to her grandmother, who handed it off to her cook. Exalta then linked her arm through Angus's and escorted him to the library for cocktails and canapés. At Thanksgiving, Exalta always served cherry stones on the half shell, a relish tray with French dressing and cocktail peanuts. Blair helped herself to a clam, and then a few moments later bolted for the bathroom in the back of the house, the commode the servants used, because she was going to vomit. A week later, it was confirmed. She was pregnant. Her dream of attending Harvard would be put on hold. Blair wrote the admissions committee a letter explaining that she found herself with child and would like to defer enrollment until the following year or the year after that. She heard nothing back. Probably, they felt they didn't need to respond because they accepted as a matter of course what Blair could not. She would never attend Harvard. Indeed, the pregnancy disrupted even the meager routine Blair had established for herself on Commonwealth Avenue. She was absolutely flattened. Entire days slipped past when she didn't even leave the apartment. The nausea set in at 5 in the afternoon like clockwork. Blair spent at least an hour on her knees in front of the toilet, retching. The only things that kept the nausea at bay were smoking and a small glass of scotch, which was odd because normally Blair drank gin, but her pregnant body craved brown liquor. The older and more complex, the better. On the day Blair chose to put up the Christmas tree, her mother came over to help. Between the two of them, they managed to wrangle the tree onto the stand, and then Kate went about stringing the lights while Blair collapsed on the divan with a cigarette and 2 fingers of Glenlivet, willing the nausea to just leave her alone for once. She had invited her mother and David for dinner and planned to serve cheese fondue. She'd painstakingly cubed a loaf of sourdough and sliced some cured sausage, both provisioned that morning from Savinor's. Angus had called at lunchtime and said he would be working late again, and Blair wanted to cancel the dinner altogether, but Kate insisted that Blair needed company, so now Blair could look forward to a lopsided fondue dinner with her parents. She watched her mother wind the lights around the tree, infinitely patient, careful, thorough, and competent in her task. She wore a dark green shirtwaist and pumps and had pearls at her throat. Her blonde hair was in a smooth chignon, her lipstick perfect. Kate was always put together, always impeccable. How did she manage it? Blair knew that her mother had suffered dark times. Blair's father,
Wilder Foley, had been fighting in Korea for much of the last years of their early marriage, and then when he came home, there were, as Kate put it, adjustments to make. Blair remembered her father's homecoming. They picked him up at the airport. He was wearing his dress uniform. She remembers him at the breakfast table in a white undershirt, smoking and eating eggs, pulling Kate down into his lap and growling at Blair to take her sister and brother upstairs to play. Wilder didn't drive Blair to school or ballet. Her mother did. Her mother prepared their food, administered their baths, read them stories, and tucked them in. Blair remembered one night her parents had gone out for dinner. Her mother wore a red sheath and her father his dress uniform, and Janie Beckett from down the street had come to babysit, which had been a matter of great excitement. Kate had bought Coke to offer Janie, and Blair had sneaked peeks at the three exotic green bottles in the icebox. The Foley children weren't allowed soda. That night, Janie gave Blair one sip of the Coke. It had been so crisp and spicy and unexpectedly fizzy that Blair's eyes had teared up and her nose tingled. She had retained all of those details, but relatively little about her own father. And then, suddenly, he was dead. Kate had found Wilder's body in his garage workshop, a gunshot wound to his head. On that morning, Blair had been taken to the park by her grandfather, which was unusual indeed. When she got home, there had been men at the house, so many men. Neighbors, Mr. Beckett, Janie's father, a swarm of policemen, and later, bizarrely, Bill Crimmins, the caretaker for the house in Nantucket. Blair doesn't remember being told that her father was dead. Possibly she overheard something or just intuited it. Nor does Blair remember her mother screaming or even crying. This struck Blair as unusual only when she was older. When Blair was 16, she and Kate had an argument about Blair's public displays of affection with her boyfriend, Larry Winter, and Blair turned Kate's composure during this time against her, saying, "You didn't even cry when Daddy died. You didn't shed one tear." And Kate had spun on her in an uncharacteristic show of anger. "What do you know about it? Tell me, please, Blair Basket Foley. What do you know about it?" Blair had to admit that she knew nothing about it, really. And that was true to this day. Kate must have been devastated, haunted, and set adrift by her husband's unexpected death. Blair was tempted to ask her mother now what it had been like to find him, how she had coped afterward. Blair wondered if she could learn something about her own marriage by asking Kate those questions. But at that moment, her mother held her hands up to showcase the tree. The lights were evenly hung at different depths on the branches in a way that created a glowing three-dimensional marvel. "What do you think?" Kate asked. Blair admired her mother so much, she couldn't summon words strong enough to praise her. She nodded her approval. Everyone promised Blair she would feel better during her second trimester, and this proved to be true. The month of April delivered the sweet spot in her pregnancy. The nausea was gone, and the exhaustion had abated somewhat. Blair's hair was long and shiny. Her appetite for both food and sex was prodigious. But Angus was even more distant and remote, and he suffered his episodes more frequently. The only days he took off from work, he spent lying in bed, despondent. On Tuesday, April 8th, 2 days after Easter, Blair woke up and immediately consumed 2 grilled cheese sandwiches, a butterscotch pudding, 3 chocolate coconut eggs, and a handful of black jelly beans from the Easter basket that Exalta still prepared for all 4 of her grandchildren, even though 3 of them were adults. It was a glorious spring day, warm for the first time in months. Blair, energized by the sudden sugar rush, decided to walk from their apartment all the way over to the MIT campus and surprise Angus at work. She wore one of her new maternity dresses, a full-term size, even though she was only 5.5 months pregnant. Her girth was a source of private embarrassment. She was so big. Exalta had commented on it with disapproval at Easter, and Blair had feared that Exalta might even withhold her Easter basket. Blair had no explanation for her size, except that everything about her pregnancy had been extreme. She had been so sick and so tired, and now she was so enormous. She assumed it meant that the baby would be a strapping, healthy boy, smart like Angus, handsome like Joey, athletic like Tiger. Blair wore low, stacked heels, comfortable for walking. But when she reached Marlborough Street, a tiny, blue-haired woman stopped her on the sidewalk, told her she had no right to be out in her condition, and implored her to return home. Blair stared at the woman, aghast. "But I'm only 5 months along," she said. She immediately regretted giving out this piece of personal information. One thing she had noticed with dismay was that being pregnant made her public property. It meant that old women who had probably given birth at the turn of the century felt they could stop her on the street and tell her to go home. Blair had moved on, indignant but self-conscious. Her maternity dress was buttercup yellow, which suited the spring day, but also made her stand out. She had been looking forward to strolling over the Longfellow Bridge and watching the rowers below. But after she'd walked a few more blocks, a taxi cab pulled up alongside her. The driver cranked down the passenger side window and said, "Lady, where are you going? I'll give you a ride for free." Blair thought about protesting, but her feet were starting to complain, and the bridge was still a ways off, and MIT 10 to 12 blocks beyond that. "Thank you," she said, and accepted the ride. When Blair reached the astrophysics department, she was informed by the receptionist, a graduate student who introduced himself as Dobbins, that Angus was out. "Out?" Blair said. "What does that mean?" Dobbins was wearing a Glen plaid suit with a matching bow tie and pocket square. Jaunty, Blair thought, but his expression was dour. The department secretary, Mrs. Himstead, had retired in January, and Angus and his colleagues had been too busy to find a replacement, so they assigned graduate students the odious tasks that Mrs. Himstead used to handle. Most of the graduate students felt put upon, as young Dobbins clearly did. He also seemed to be offended by Blair's pregnant state. He watched her warily, as though he thought she might burst. Professor Whalen had an appointment at 10. Blair had started out the day with a strong sense of optimism, but it was rapidly dissolving. "Where is the appointment?" "I can't tell you that."
"I'm his wife."
"I'm sorry," Dobbins said.
"Please just tell me where he went. Is he somewhere on campus?"
"Actually," Dobbins said, "it was a personal appointment."
"Personal?"
"That's what he said. Personal."
"Personal," Blair thought. "Where could he be?"
He had his hair cut every other Saturday without deviation, and he wasn't scheduled to see the dentist until the following month.
She said, "I'll wait for him to return."
Dobbins pushed his glasses farther up the bridge of his nose and turned his attention to a textbook on the desk before him. Blair took a seat in a straight-back chair and perched her handbag on what remained of her lap. She eyed Dobbins and caught him glancing up from his studying to inspect her with obvious distaste. He was probably made uncomfortable by her fecundity. So many men were. She sat for more than 30 minutes, and was about to get up and leave. She would take a taxi home, she decided, because the sitting was causing her lower back to ache, when Angus came rushing through the door.
"Angus!"
Blair cried out, both relieved and joyful. She struggled to her feet. The expression on Angus's face wasn't one she remembered seeing before. He looked caught. He looked guilty of something. And then Blair noticed he was in a state of disarray, his tie askew, his suit jacket misbuttoned, and his hair mussed. Blair blinked.
"Where were you?"
she asked.
What are you doing here? He asked.
Then an instant later, he added, I was at a department meeting.
Blair looked to Dobbins, who had wisely fixed his gaze on his textbook again. This nice young gentleman told me you were at an appointment. A personal appointment. Who was it with?
Would you excuse us, please, Dobbins?
Angus said.
Dobbins didn't need to be asked twice. If there was anything worse for Dobbins than being confronted with a pregnant woman, Blair supposed, it was being plopped in the middle of a marital squabble. He darted off down the hall.
What are you doing here? Angus asked again.
I came to surprise you,
Blair said, and then she dissolved in tears. She was fat, so fat, filled to bursting with child and fluids. She was an overripe fruit. She was oozing, unctuous, moist, pungent. Blair had to urinate so badly and had lost so much control over her bladder that she feared she would piss a river right then and there.
I need the ladies' room, she told Angus. Right now!
Angus seemed relieved by this distraction. However, finding a ladies' room was a problem. The population of the building was so overwhelmingly male that there was only one ladies' room, and it was on the first floor. This involved an elevator ride and a walk down a hushed hallway past closed doors behind which, Blair assumed, men were busy calculating. All the while, Blair was praying she didn't leak. Also, she was wondering about the identity of Angus's mistress. That Angus had a mistress, she had no doubt. Most professors would have chosen a student, but all of Angus's students were male, every single one, and his colleagues in his department were men. It could be one of the other wives, maybe the Joanne who wore all the turquoise eyeshadow. Or it could be a stewardess from one of the flights Angus had taken the previous fall. Blair finally reached the ladies' room, and she was so relieved to release her bladder that nothing else mattered. And then when she emerged, Angus announced that her visit was a lovely surprise, but that he had to get back to work. He would see her at home. But, Blair said. Angus kissed her and pressed $2 into her hand for a taxi. Then he smiled, which was rare these days. She supposed he was saving his smiles for the other woman. I love you, he said, but the words rang hollow. Blair moved toward the exit, then stopped.
Angus, she said.
Angus, about to step into the elevator, held the door and turned around. Yes, darling? She wanted to say something terrible like, I'm sorry I married you instead of Joey, or I'm attending Harvard the instant this baby is born, no matter what you say. She would not stand idly by while Angus lied to her. But she couldn't start a fight here, in a public building, his place of employment. She had been raised better than that.
Fix your jacket, she said. You missed a button.
Time of the season. Her mother drives the Grand Wagoneer, and her grandmother sits up front. Without Kirby or Tiger along, Jessie has the entire back seat to herself, so she's able to lie down, resting her head on one of the duffels. The Wagoneer is jam-packed with trunks and valises, boxes and bags, piled to within an inch of the roof. There is no way to see out the back. There never is on this trip, even though every year David implores Kate to bring less paraphernalia, and every year Kate promises to bring only the bare necessities. Much of the cargo is clothes, of course, for Exalta, for Kate, for Jessie, for David, and even for Tiger, just in case the war ends at some point over the summer and he is sent home. Their summer wardrobes are completely different from what they wear the rest of the year in Boston. Kate packs Lily Pulitzer patio dresses, espadrilles, a different bathing suit for every day of the week, clam diggers, Bermuda shorts, boat neck tees, her tennis dresses, and treat horns. Jessie brings basically the same thing, although on a younger, less sophisticated scale. She has terry cloth play suits, a pair of white bell-bottoms, two sundresses for dinners out at restaurants, a crocheted vest, and a Fair Isle sweater for the inevitable rainy days. There's a small trunk filled with foul weather gear, raincoats, hats, boots, umbrellas. There's a box of cooking implements, Kate's cast iron pan and her chef's knife and butcher block. There's a cooler of steaks and French cheese from Savinor's, because Nantucket is okay for seafood, but everything else is subpar compared to the city, according to both Kate and Exalta. Jessie brought her summer reading, Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, and her new record album. There are tennis rackets and clam rakes, new life preservers for the boat, new wicker baskets for the bicycles. The drive along Route 93 and then Route 3 is dull, and Jessie's mind wanders. She isn't sure she'll be brave enough to ask Exalta if she can play Joni Mitchell on the Magnavox. Her grandmother listens to big band records. Glenn Miller is her favorite. Her mother is a little better. She likes Ricky Nelson and the Beach Boys. Jessie wishes her own taste in music were cooler. Kirby likes Steppenwolf and the Rolling Stones, and Tiger listens to Led Zeppelin and The Who. Will Tiger remember to send letters to Nantucket? Jessie kind of doubts it, so that means she'll have to wait for David to bring the letters down on the weekends. She feels a twinge in her abdomen. Is it maybe a cramp? Might her period be coming? She suspects it's simple dread. They will get takeout tonight from Susie's snack bar at the end of Strait Wharf like they always do on the first night. And then tomorrow, Jessie will start her tennis lessons at the Field and Oar Club. But what will she do with her afternoons? Go to the beach with her mother? Her mother likes to drive all the way out to Ram Pasture because there is never anyone there. She can plant her chair and read, sleep, and swim in peace. Ram Pasture is the only beach Exalta will go to as well. Sometimes she and Kate go together. Exalta wears a wide-brimmed straw hat and a bathing suit with a skirt. Jessie envisions herself next to her mother and grandmother. It's a happy picture of three generations enjoying a deserted beach, except nothing could be further from the truth. Jessie, Kate says, startling Jessie. What? Yes, mother, Kate prompts. Yes, mother, Jessie says, sitting up. Her mother is a stickler for manners when Exalta is around. The bridge, Kate says. The Sagamore Bridge is suddenly before them, distinctive and majestic, an arc of steel girders. Objectively, Jessie supposes, it's quite hideous, but even so, Jessie feels a rush of fondness for it. Seeing the Sagamore means that summer is beginning, and Jessie is surprised to feel something like anticipation. The air smells like salt and pine, and as Kate drives over the crest of the bridge, Jessie sees boats slicing through the water of the Cape Cod Canal. This optimism lasts all the way to the ferry dock. Driving the Wagoneer into the hold of the Nobska is a ritual for the family, and Jessie suddenly feels privileged to be doing it. Blair is stuck at home in Boston with heartburn and swollen ankles. Kirby is on Martha's Vineyard among strangers. Tiger is in the jungle in Vietnam. Tiger would likely give anything to be here right now. Before Jessie complains again, even to herself, she's going to remember that. They park the car so its front bumper is right up against the back bumper of the ragtop VW bug in front of them, and Jessie is reminded of Miss Flower's juicy orange bug. But school seems very far away. It's the family's tradition to climb to the uppermost deck and take in the sea air, as Exalta says. So Jessie follows her mother and grandmother up the metal staircase, first to the main deck, where there are the men's and women's toilets, which are filled with a blue chemical instead of water, and a snack bar that sells hot dogs and chowder, and then to the upper deck, where the sun is the brightest and the breeze the strongest. Oh, look, there's Bitsy Dunscombe, Kate says. I'm going to say hello. Want to come, Mother? Heavens no, Exalta says. That whole family is tiresome. Jessie happens to agree. Bitsy Dunscombe is the mother of twins, Helen and Heather, who are Jesse's age. A friendship with the Dunscombe twins has been pressed on Jesse since early childhood. The twins are absolutely identical, each with white blonde hair in a pixie cut, freckles across her nose, a slight gap between her two front teeth, and, recently, pierced ears, which Jesse finds scandalous, since she has been taught that the proper age for a girl to get her ears pierced is 16. Heather Dunscombe is lovely and kind, while Helen Dunscombe is mean and stinky. For example, Helen routinely asks Jesse when she's getting a nose job. Jesse would be okay hanging out with just Heather, but they come as a package, so Jesse keeps her distance whenever she's given a choice. Kate saunters off, leaving Exalta and Jesse standing at the railing, staring at the water. It looks blue in the distance, but green when Jesse gazes down on it directly from above, and she knows that if she were to collect this water in a glass, it would be clear. Water has no color, she learned in science class. What people see is a reflection of light. Jesse thinks about sharing this knowledge with Exalta in order to break the silence, but Exalta is humming as though she's in some kind of meditative state, which makes her seem unlike her normal self. Finally, she turns to Jesse, tilts her head, and says, "Where did you get that necklace?" Jesse's hand flies up to touch the pendant. "My father gave it to me this morning. It's the Tree of Life." Exalta lifts it from Jesse's neck to better inspect it. "Tree of Life, you say? What does that mean?" This feels like a thorny question. "It signals maturity and responsibility," Jesse says. "In the Jewish tradition, 13 is an important age." Exalta is wearing very large, round sunglasses in the style of Jackie Kennedy Onassis, so Jesse can't judge her expression. "Today is my birthday," Jesse says. "My 13th birthday." Again, the glasses make it impossible to say whether this announcement comes as a surprise to her grandmother. It would not be unlike Exalta to forget Jesse's birthday. The only grandchild's birthday Exalta faithfully remembers is Kirby's, September 30th, because that also happens to be Exalta's birthday. This is why Kirby is her favorite, or it's one of the reasons. Exalta rests her handbag on the railing, unsnaps the ball clasp, and pulls out a small velvet box. "Happy birthday, Jessica," she says. Jesse is stunned. It takes her a moment to realize that Exalta has not only remembered her birthday, but gotten her a present, and this present is most definitively not a savings bond, which is what Jesse usually receives. She accepts the box, but waits for Exalta's encouraging nod before she pries it open. It's a necklace. The gold chain is so fine, it looks like gold dust. Hanging from the chain is a gold filigree knot in which is embedded a diamond the size of the head of a pin. "Your grandfather gave that to me on our first wedding anniversary, back in 1919, Exalta says. "Try it on." Jesse can't believe Exalta is giving her a piece of her jewelry. When Jesse was younger, she and Kirby used to tiptoe into Exalta's room and paw through the jewels, trying to guess which would be left to whom in Exalta's will. Exalta keeps an array of porcelain ring boxes on her dressing table, and Jesse adored the boxes nearly as much as the treasures they contained. Kirby's favorite ring was a black pearl held in a claw-like platinum setting. Jesse's favorite had been a trio of irregularly shaped opals set in gold. Opals had seemed magical to Jesse when she was younger. In the light, she could see they contained the entire rainbow. Blair, who had been too old to play the game but not too old to critique their choices, said that opals were garish, and Jesse had been secretly happy that Blair felt that way, because if Exalta left the ring to Blair, Blair might give it to Jesse if she asked for it. Jesse had never seen this particular necklace, but she knew that some of Exalta's more valuable pieces were kept in a case that locked, her pearls, for example, and a diamond tennis bracelet and Jesse's grandfather's Harvard class ring, the one Exalta gave to Tiger before he deployed. Jesse had never dreamed that she would receive something out of the locked case. The problem with this gift, however, is that it requires her to take off the necklace from her father. Jesse sees no alternative, so she unclasps the silver chain and slips the Tree of Life necklace into the front pocket of her shorts. She secures her grandmother's necklace around her neck, and Exalta beams and says, "Exquisite on you, as I knew it would be." Jesse forces the corners of her mouth up. She is, of course, thrilled about the necklace and about Exalta thinking her worthy of it, but she feels bad about the necklace her father gave her, the Tree of Life, which isn't in the same class as this one. She worries that Exalta somehow schemed to give Jesse the gold knot with the diamond in order to replace the Tree of Life so that Jesse won't be wearing any symbol of her Jewish heritage. What is she going to do? "We need to put that back in the box," Exalta says. "It's too precious for everyday wear. Special occasions only. I'll keep it in my room, where it will be safe." Jesse is relieved. Special occasions only. The rest of the time, she can wear the Tree of Life. For once, things have worked out perfectly. "Thank you, Nani," Jesse says, and she kisses her grandmother's cheek. Part of the appeal of Nantucket is that it never changes, which is especially important now that the rest of the country is going haywire. John F. Kennedy was shot when Jesse was in first grade, though she was too young to understand what that meant. Then last year, when Jesse was in fifth grade, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot in Memphis, and later that year, Bobby Kennedy was shot in California. Jesse's parents had been deeply unsettled by these assassinations, and Kirby had been inconsolable. "Every man who tries to move the country forward is being murdered in cold blood." And, of course, American soldiers were being killed every day in Vietnam. It's comforting for Jesse to see all the familiar signs as they roll up the cobblestones of Main Street in the Grand Wagoneer. The charcoal galley is the Greasy Spoon. It stays open late to accommodate the patrons of Bosun's Locker, the bar next door. Jesse has been taught to cross Main Street to avoid passing Bosun's Locker, which only makes it more intriguing. Charlie's Market is where her mother does the shopping, and sometimes Jesse goes along. And then there is Butner's Department Store. A few summers earlier, a housekeeper had parked her employer's Bonneville in front of the store and gone to run some errands. She returned to the car, started it up, and put it in reverse, or so she thought. She'd actually put it in drive. The curb stopped the car from moving forward, and the housekeeper, not understanding why the car wouldn't back up, hit the gas hard, which sent the vehicle shooting through the front window of Butner's. As soon as that news reached All's Fair, Tiger and Jesse ran down to view the crash. Jesse had been aghast. In her mind, the destruction caused by the car ramming into a building could never be fixed. Tiger, she remembers, had been delighted. He stood by as one policeman tried to calm the hysterical housekeeper, and another policeman tried to calm Miss Timsey, a longtime sales lady at Butner's, and the photographer from the Inquirer and Mirror snapped pictures. The car had practically no damage, and, luckily, no one had been hurt. For 2 weeks, Butner's window had been covered with brown paper, but then, one day, the glass was back in, and a man came and painted on the lettering in black and gold, and it was just like nothing had ever happened. They pass Claire Elaine's beauty shop and Mitchell's book corner, new last year, and the sweet shop, where Jessie will go with her father to eat malachite chip ice cream and air her grievances. After they pass the Pacific Bank, they are on Upper Main Street, where most of Exalta's friends live. Some families come to the island before Memorial Day, but Exalta feels it's still too chilly in May. She has claimed the third Monday in June as her arrival day. On Thursday of this week, Jesse knows, the Inquirer and Mirror will announce that Mrs. Pennington, Exalta Nichols, is in residence at her home on Fair Street for the summer after spending the winter at her home on Mount Vernon Street in Boston. The entire family believes that Fair Street is the prettiest road on the entire island. It's narrow, and traffic runs one way into town. Fair connects to only small side streets, so there aren't many passing cars. The homes on Fair Street are old but well cared for. Most of them are gray shingled with trim freshly painted white every few summers. Some of the neighbors engage in unofficial competitions for the best window boxes, which Exalta claims is a preposterous waste of time. But Jesse and Kirby used to have fun riding their bikes up and down the street, awarding first, second, and third prizes to the geraniums, petunias, pansies, and impatiens. Nearly all the homes have names: Fair and Square, Fairy Tale, Family Affair. Exalta's house, which is distinctive because of its yellow clapboard front, is called All's Fair, taken from the saying, "All's Fair in Love and War." A few houses down on the right is Jessie's favorite, a white Victorian with a turret and fancy fretwork, although she keeps her preference to herself because she knows Exalta would be offended and might even tell Jessie to go knock on the Blackstock's door and see if she can live with them since she likes that house so much. They park the Wagoneer on a side street, Plum Lane. Mr. Crimmins, the caretaker, appears out of nowhere to open Exalta's door and help her out of the car. "Oh, Bill," Exalta says, "you didn't have to meet us. I know you're busy."
"You look as lovely as ever, Exalta," Mr. Crimmins says.
He takes Exalta's hand and gazes at her for a second.
"I was sorry to hear about Tiger being sent over."
"He'll be just fine," Exalta says, and she extracts her hand from his. Mr. Crimmins turns to Jesse's mother.
"Katie, how are you?"
"Bill, you got my letter? About the..."
"It's all set," he says. "As it were. In the den, like you asked."
Mr. Crimmins winks at Jesse.
"It looks like you've grown a whole foot there, Miss Jessica."
He pulls a green apple-flavored Now and Later out of his shirt pocket and hands it to Jesse. This, too, is a tradition. Mr. Crimmins has met Jesse with a green apple Now and Later for as long as she can remember, though today, for the first time, accepting it feels childish. At 13, she is too mature and responsible to be interested in candy, and yet refusing it is unthinkable.
"Thank you," she says.
"And some mail came for you," Mr. Crimmins says.
As he reaches into his back pocket, Jessie's heart leaps. A letter from Tiger. Her mother must be thinking the same thing because she steps forward in anticipation. But what Mr. Crimmins produces is a postcard. He hands it to Jessie. The front shows a picture of Coolidge Corner in Brookline. Confused, Jessie flips the card over and reads, "Dear Jessie, summer is boring. I miss you so, so, so much. Your friend forever, Doris."
"It's from Doris," Jessie says.
Her mother sighs. Exalta, Kate, and Jessie go through the wrought iron gate on the side of the property and walk up the brick steps to the back door. The only people who use the front door are guests. The kitchen runs the entire length of the rear of the house. It has a brick fireplace oven, which makes entering the kitchen feel like stepping back into colonial times. The first owner of the house was a man named Ebenezer Raymond, who was a blacksmith. Ebenezer's two brothers were carpenters, and they'd built the house for him in 1795. Back then, many people died young, and newborn babies died all the time. Ebenezer got married, but his wife died. He married again, and then at age 38, Ebenezer died. His second wife continued living in the house with their child and two of the children from Ebenezer's first marriage. There are so many people who've died in All's Fair that Jessie can't believe the house isn't haunted like some of the other houses on Nantucket. But then again, Jessie can't imagine Exalta tolerating a ghost, or a ghost tolerating Exalta. The house smells the same,
which is to say it smells old and dusty like a museum. Jesse's grandfather used to smoke a pipe, and a hint of his tobacco lingers. Jesse has Anne Frank in one hand and her most important suitcase, the one with a record album, in the other. But she drops both at the bottom of the stairs so she can peek into the front rooms. To the right is the formal living room, which has a mural painted across three of the four walls. It's a scene of Nantucket circa 1845, the year before the Great Fire destroyed downtown, which guests ooh and ah about when they first see it. At the far end of the living room, in an alcove that is almost but not quite a separate room, is Jesse's grandfather's desk and leather armchair. The oldest antique in the house is a wooden spinning wheel said to have belonged to Ebenezer Raymond's daughter. Years ago, before Jesse was born, Kirby spun the wheel too fast and broke the pedal. Exalta demanded an apology, which Kirby refused to give. And so Exalta punished her by shutting her up in the buttery, a dark little closet under the stairs where in olden times they stored the butter and milk, for 10 whole minutes, a prospect that terrifies Jesse. When Kirby emerged from the buttery, she still wouldn't apologize, and Exalta had famously called her a little rebel and then given her a piece of strawberry candy. To the left of the stairs is the den, which has a fireplace, a console that houses the Magnavox, and a collection of whirligigs and whimmy-diddles, which are one of Exalta's passions. Jesse has always been fascinated by her grandmother's collection, and seeing them again each year is nearly like seeing friends. There's the Indian chief with his long feathered headdress sitting upright in his canoe with paddles that move, a blue whale with fins that flip, a farmer bending over to be repeatedly kicked in the rear by his mule, a little Dutch boy and girl kissing next to a windmill with arms that spin, and Exalta's favorite, the mustached man in red-striped pajamas riding an old-fashioned tricycle. Jesse takes stock of the whirligigs and picks some up to maneuver their moving parts, but gently, so as not to break them. The last thing she wants is to be stuffed into the buttery. When she turns to leave, she sees something so surprising that she cries out. There's a television, a big one, sitting on a stand in the corner. Jesse approaches tentatively, as though the television is a spaceship that might blast off at any moment. That's how unlikely its presence in this house is. The set is even bigger than the one in Doris's house. And Doris has the biggest TV of anyone at school because Doris's father likes to watch the commercials for McDonald's. The television is plugged in, and a rabbit ears antenna sits on top. Gingerly, Jesse turns the knob, and the screen illuminates to show a sea of gray fuzz. Jesse switches the